Okay, this is part two of my interview with Diane English at her home. It's the 20th of May, 2006. My name is Sarah Tucson, and I'm interviewing for the Southern Oral History Program, the Long Civil Rights Movement Project. Diane, I thought we would first just go back over some of the organizations and activities you've been involved with in the neighborhood, and I wanted to get a slightly clearer picture of how it all fits together. You were saying in our first interview that you work for the Neighborhood Association. You first became involved with that when you moved here, and that's the same thing as the Belmont Strategy Force, is that right?
Yes, that's the community. It's called the Belmont Neighborhood Community Strategy Force.
Okay.
That's our neighborhood association. We just use neighborhood association since the name is so long.
Oh, yeah.
And I also reformed the Community Watch Program in our neighborhood in 2000. And I also helped redevelop our Community Development Corporation, which is our CDC.
Okay. And the Strategy Force, also known as the Neighborhood Association, was formed in 1986?
Yes, it was formed in 1986 by another group of people at that time.
Were the folks who sat on that all neighborhood residents, or did it include representatives of the city as well?
It's all neighborhood residents and your business owners that live, they have businesses within the neighborhood. Mm-hmm. And no, we don't have any city people that sit on our boards at all.
Oh, yeah. And you became president of that organization at some point, right?
In 2003, I became the president of the Neighborhood Association.
Okay. How long is the typical term there?
We have a rotation of 3 years, and then you are re-elected, or if at that time, at the end of 3 years, there is not another person that would be running, then you can be re-elected for an additional 3 years, but at the end of 6 years, you have to step down.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
So are you currently still holding?
I'm currently still there.
Oh, yeah. And then the Belmont Community Development Corporation, what year did that form?
That was formed, that was non-functioning when I came into the neighborhood in 93. That hadn't functioned in years, and as we moved into the neighborhood, as we got involved with the association and the Community Watch Program, we became aware of this not the CDC not functioning, so we started a committee and went forward with the city, and the city said, okay, we'll come in and help y'all redevelop y'all's corporation. And we spun about a year or 6 months going back through the process of reorganizing our whole CDC with new bylaws and assessments and all this type of stuff. It took us about 6 months to a year.
And so there had been one in the past,
yeah,
just wasn't functioning.
It wasn't functioning
I see. So would you say that the time that you were reforming the group was maybe around 2000 or so?
It was during 2000.
Okay.
Also.
And how is the function of the CDC different from the Strategy Force?
The CDC constructs affordable housing. They do a lot of financial business work, like to get people homes, to help them to get qualified. They do the funding for the home buyers, stuff of that nature. But they have been known to do community efforts work also. Shh, I'm busy.
Can we pause it for a minute?
Yeah, I'm busy. Go. It's for something else now. Bye, go back outside and shut the door. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Okay. But they have initiatives. The CDC has initiatives that they have to perform in order to stay in existence in the neighborhood.
Some
of the things that we do, but we try to do different things so that we won't be walking over each other with the same projects. So they mainly stick with financing, home buyers, and stuff of that nature.
And they do have partnerships with city representatives,
yeah,
right?
They do, and our CDC just so happened to have to be funded by the city because we did not have funds on our own to actually start it up with.
Oh, yeah.
So it is being funded through the city, and that director is being paid through the city and grant funds.
Oh, yeah. Are there any other organizations that are Belmont-based that I'm leaving out that you've been involved with?
No, we have all kinds in the neighborhood, but basically, they pop up every day. Mm-hmm. And you hear about them one day, and they're disappeared the next day. We do have Right Moves to Youth, but that's non-functioning because the lady that was running it just fell through the cracks. Mm. So it's a lot of things we have that are available, mm-hmm. but they were given, different people took on those responsibilities, so it just fell through the crack. When they got tired of it and they couldn't get a whole bunch of responses to it, they just dropped it. And so now the association is going back trying to pick up on some of these things so that it can distribute it out mm-hmm. evenly throughout the neighborhood, so all the neighborhood would be aware of the different programs that we have.
What's the biggest challenge in sustaining an organization and making it last?
Keeping people interested, mm-hmm. on the go, mm-hmm. Motivated, mm-hmm. Keeping your residents mainly informed is the biggest problem, mm-hmm. because you have to have the residents have to be involved in order for the association to function properly. Mm-hmm. We can function all day, and without the input of the neighborhood residents, it wouldn't be run as an association. It would be more like a group of people running a neighborhood, and it should be residents running the neighborhood, mm-hmm. through the association, and the association should be is the resort to where you go to make sure that their wants, needs, and efforts are put forth to wherever, mm-hmm. to make sure we are heard,
right,
and make sure we're going in the right direction, because we do take a lot of training classes. The city offers a lot of training classes. We find out from other groups of people about training classes, so we attend some of those. Mm-hmm. So it's basically a learning situation all the time.
What sorts of training classes have you taken?
Leadership, management. I went through the anger management programs that they have. I had went through their resource classes, partnership classes, financial assistance, how to get people interested in participating, organizational training, organizational skill training. It's been several, it's many of them.
So this has really been a learning process.
For me, I've learned a lot in the last 3 years. I think I've learned more the last 3 years than I ever have in a lifetime. Mm-hmm. But it's interesting because it's always something new.
Mm-hmm. Thinking about all of your activism in the neighborhood, who would you say have been your most important allies?
The residents are my most important allies, because I can go to them and talk. Without their support, you really can't do anything. I think working as a group has more power than an individual's voice. So usually I talk a lot to the residents, and they talk, and I try to put it together in my own words, because sometimes they have a tendency to tell you something, but they mean something else. Mm-hmm. So I have to constantly go back and say, well, did you really mean, can we talk about it again before I actually try to find someone? And I'm good for picking up the phone and calling, mm-hmm. because we have what they call a neighborhood list. Of all of your different neighborhoods and presidents and stuff of that nature. If I have a problem, and I'll pick up the phone and I'll just go through those and ask, have you ever had such and such thing happen to you, and where could I get some help, and what kind of resources? And usually they're pretty good at it.
So if the residents have been your most important ally, who would you say has been, who do you see as your most significant opponents in some of the fights that you've tried to push?
The city of Charlotte, because they are so huge and they have so many different departments. And I think where the breakdown comes with us is you talk to one person, and then it lingers, and they have to go through a due process to get it to the right person, and then it lays, and that person is so busy doing other things. So Right now, it's the city. Mm-hmm. And we're working on them. I mean, we have a coordinator, which is named Randy Harris. He's good. He's really good, but he's just so tied up, and he's, you know, involved in so many other issues. To it's sort of hard to catch up with him and to sit down and actually do some of the things that we really are pushed to ask about. But he's good.
What do you see as the ideal role that the local government should be playing, or state or federal government should be playing, in helping people find affordable housing, sustain neighborhoods?
I see, well, in the past, I've noticed that the state, the city, all these different people are involved in it, but they seem to run over the top of each other, and nothing ever gets settled in the neighborhoods. To me, it would be, I think I read a while back where they said the communities themselves should be able to operate on their own. It should be a way that they could train the neighborhood people to the point to where they could go to the state and pull funds or ask for things that particular neighborhood needs and obtain those resources without the red tape of going through the city, the state, and blah, 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 and it's on and on and on. I'm trying to interview right here, so stop coming through here, please.
Pause it.
But yeah, I wish they would just put it back into the hands of the communities. It seems to me like you have communities that do all of their work within that community, and it seems that those residents are much happier people because they can get things done and they don't have to wait around months to a year for permission of this and for a budget for this. Mm-hmm. And you can just actually go out and do. And, you know, usually it's like the state relates to the city and then the city relates to the community.
Mm. Has the media helped or hurt your work in Belmont?
The media has helped our work because at one point in time we couldn't get any type of outside resource help.
Mm.
And I think they had a couple of coverages on us, and we just got people from everywhere wanting to come in and help to do things.
Was it the Charlotte Observer or the TV media?
It was the Charlotte Observer. Did a big write-up on it, on our neighborhood.
And after that, things started happening?
Yeah, sort of, after we made them happen.
Uh-huh.
We sort of pushed it to happen because we had barricades that were put up in 1998 in our neighborhood. And we sort of demanded that they come down. Well, we asked that they come down because we were told they were temporary for the...
I think it didn't catch that last little bit. So if you don't mind, let me just get you to explain the barricades once more. The barricades were put up to decrease crime
and cut down on the trafficking. They said driving, the people that was driving through buying drugs or whatever, which it did help with that part, and it did help subside some of the crime in here because the people couldn't drive through to get their dope. Mm-hmm. And my street, as I've said, Kennan Street was a very hot street when I moved in here. Mm-hmm. So it was like everybody came Kennan Street to purchase drugs, because all your drug dealers used to hang on Kennan Street.
Yeah.
But during this, after 6 years, 98, we approached the city about where the police department, in reference to when would they be taking the barricades down.
Huh.
And then that's when we were told they're permanent. And we're like, well, nobody told us. You told us they were temporary, they could come down whenever. But I don't think they wanted them to come down.
So in 98, they'd been up 6 years.
Yeah.
Wow.
And we were determined. After 6 years, I'm tired of running the block to get in and out. And then, you know, people on this street here would have to take all the way around the block to go to one section. And it was just beginning to be bugged out. And if you're talking about revitalizing a neighborhood, who'd want to buy a home where you got barricades sitting in the middle of the neighborhood? I mean, it doesn't look feasible to me. I would be turned off by it. And they weren't the pretty barricades. These were some wooden sticks and some red. And then they had this dirt and stuff all around it where it was supposed to be pretty flowers. But the flowers, the people always stomped the flowers. They always trashed the area.
Huh.
So the people on the corner usually had to clean that up along with anything else. And then the flowers died. It was just horrible. And then the weeds would grow up. And if we didn't cut them, the city never cut them. You know, and if you're going to own a piece of property in our neighborhood, at least take care of it. And they, you know, so we just decided maybe it's time for them to come down if we're going to revitalize our neighborhood. That way it would make it more presentable to people that's coming through. You'd have more assets in our neighborhoods because we need all the assets. Because we have a large neighborhood. We have, what, 3,500 people in our neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a large neighborhood and all of the kids. We just need more, as much assets in and out that we can get, because every thing that happens downtown, the bike-a-thons, the run-a-thons, they all want to run through Belmont for some reason. So, I mean, if they're running this way, we're blocked in because at that time. So the police department told us that they couldn't take them down. It would cost X amount of money, $5,000, blah, blah, blah. And we were like, no, you didn't tell us we had to pay to take them down because you said they were temporary. So this went on for about 6 months, I believe. They had to do surveys to find out. We did a petition for the residents to have it taken down. Then the police department decided, well, we need to do our own survey because it may just be because you people that live on the corners that is bothering the most, and maybe the other residents see it as a help still. And we outbidded them, so we had more petition names than they had. So they finally, it took them another 6 months to come up with the monies to take the barricades down, which we had one at Kennan and Parson. We had one at Kennan and Olmsted.
Okay, so two different places.
Yeah,
okay.
But they're both on Kennan. You go down Kennan, and these are the side streets coming from Parkwood over onto Kennan Street, because Kennan was your hot spot.
And so when did they finally come down then?
It took them until 2001, I believe. I think they take them down. They took them down like in 2001 or 2000. I really can't remember that date, but it took us almost a year before they brought them down.
So what was the effect of taking them down?
We had the news media press. They came out and did this big write-up about it. And I don't think the police department didn't like it too well. But they were invited, and they were here, you know, and they just wanted to make sure that that was the thing we needed to do to keep down the traffic and the drug problems. And so far, we've done that.
Without the barricades.
Without the barricades. And it was going to happen anyway without the barricades, because to me, that helped with the traffic flow at that time, because nobody was really into the community watch program. A lot of people over here were afraid to call 911. A lot of people didn't, you know, communicate that they felt unsafe. They would just stay in their houses. At night, they wouldn't come out. You couldn't sit on your porch or entertain because of the gunfire and the drug dealers standing around and robberies, you know, just anytime. After the community watch program went into effect, and they knew that it was a lot of people signed up for it, I think it slowed down the crime a lot. So we felt more at ease, really.
Why were folks previously afraid to call 911?
Well, because it was so prevalent. The drug dealers were so prevalent in the neighborhood. And these are people that was born and raised in this neighborhood. They actually live in the neighborhood. And some of them were just, some of your elderly people, they would help them out financially. So, I mean, if you're getting some type of financial assistance that you don't ordinarily have, it might have a problem with you calling 911. But I didn't know of anybody in particular that it happened to, but that was what we were told by some of the police officers, that maybe some of these elderly people are being assisted because the drug dealers hung out at their on their properties. But I think they just hung out because they knew those people, and they knew they felt safer on their property. I don't think they were, you know, okay, you can hang out here, but it just happened that way, like my house. It just happened.
Yeah.
I never said it's okay, and you could tell them, and it would be okay, not today, but then they would be right back that same evening. And then they would even double. It would be two or three. Then the next thing you're like, it's about 15, 20 of them, so what do you do then?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
You don't go out fist fighting. You don't go out hollering and screaming. And if you dial 911, back then at that time, we had a lot of problem with the officers. I don't know if it was a dispatch system they had. You would call for 911, and then the officer would knock on your door. It was almost like the drug dealer standing here and the police, you know, knocking on your door and you talking to them. And then the next thing you know, you got flat tires on your car. Because I went through, what, about 12 flat tires. You know, it was like an ordinary thing, you know, from people flattening your tires, you know.
You suspected these were drug dealers who did this?
I have no idea. Yeah. It never fazed me as to why. But I knew it had to do something with me working with the community watch and just walking the neighborhood, and everybody knew me. But I don't think it was any of the drug dealers, because I didn't really, it was nothing really going on. I would talk to them just like ordinary people. I respected them and they started respecting me. I had no problem. But I think it was more of maybe some kids or something like that. Nothing big. I dealt with it and kept going, so.
So, do you talk with your children and grandchildren about your activism?
They are a part of it. They were here. My kids were actually living here when we moved in. Well, one of my daughters was, and the other one came later. And they stayed for a couple of years, but yeah, they actually participate a lot in it. They go to a lot of the training. My two daughters go to a lot of the training. My grandkids are from the Belmont Downman Youth Council. So
what does that group do?
It deals with kids, at-risk youth. And what we do is try to keep them occupied with healthy things. We try to take them out of the neighborhood. We try to teach them about art. We take them to maybe send them to art classes. They like to go see some of the things that's not what you see in your neighborhood all the time. We let them know that it is another life outside of the crime, the neighborhood being in its shape that it's in now. But there are other people and there are other places that you can go.
So where have you taken them?
Well, they have went swimming. They love to go swimming. We take them to the aquatic center. We take them to the movies. We took them to a farm, some kind of animal farm up in, way out in the country where you have all these animals and horses, and we spent the day there so they can learn, see about the animals in the woods, and they love country life. I don't know why they love. I guess because the kids there had these motorbikes and all this stuff, and they didn't have to worry about cars and stuff of that nature. We've taken them, they've had martial arts. They took martial arts for, 3 years? They have done a little bit of everything now. And usually we started out with about 30 children, and as we went through, they've sort of dwindled. Most of them have moved out, and the ones that were involved, they either pulled out or just got disinterested during the last year or so, because they really don't want to stay situated. And sometimes you have to be situated in order to grow. And we don't think taking you to a movie, ice skating and roller skating is the best of all things to be doing all the time. You can learn other processes, how to organize, which we're trying to get him into some youth leadership programs, because Shamario, my oldest grandson, is the president.
Oh, so it runs in the family.
He's just the type. He likes to know things about what he's, you know, he's nosy. He loves to go to all of the meetings that I go to. He goes to the trainings, some of the trainings I have. So he's learning, and that's good.
What would you most like your children and grandchildren to remember about your own work in the neighborhood?
That there is a good side to everything. It may not look good at that particular time because they're always on my back. You really need to drop all of that and just let it ride. And they would prefer me to shut the house down and just move. Just come and live with them. That way you can save your money. You don't have to worry about fixing that old house. You don't have to worry about some people running around with guns. You don't have to worry about the grandkids getting hurt, blah, blah, blah. So Yeah, they would love to see me just shut it down and move on.
What keeps you from doing that?
My individuality. Mm-hmm. I want to be an individual. And I don't know, I just like to speak out about things because I feel like if nobody ever speaks out about it, it just goes undone. I mean, that's how we've gotten this far. Somebody took the initiative to speak out. And if nobody speaks out, where are we going? Nowhere. We're going to stay stuck, right? Stuck like glue in the same spot. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I can voice my opinion. Not even living here, I can voice my opinion, which I always will, regardless if I'm here or anywhere. I have a voice, and I do use my voice. Mm-hmm. And I do a lot of research before I use my voice. It's not like a off-the-spare-the-moment speech. Mm-hmm. If I'm going to talk about something, I'm going to go research it first. I like to be right when I speak out. Mm-hmm. So that's why I don't classify myself as an activist, because mm-hmm. I do research first. Mm-hmm. I think activists go on impulses more so than they do actually do. But they probably do research, because all the ones that I know, they're like, it's an impulse thing. That, you know, they feel it comes out, they work at it, and they solve it. But me, I like to go back, I like to read about something, mm-hmm. I get to ask somebody something, and then I'll feel more comfortable. If I know what I'm talking about, then I can relay it to you better.
Mm-hmm. What would you say, thinking about all your years working in the neighborhood, is your proudest accomplishment?
Proudest accomplishment? I've had a lot of those, I think. Well, when I first did the Community Watch program, I didn't feel comfortable because it was my first experience trying to form and organize stuff. But the best one was when I actually, being the president, I guess, for a while, it was like, okay, we can do this. We've accomplished a lot of things. And right now, I'm at that point to where there's nothing that I don't, that the community people can talk about that I don't feel like I can accomplish for them. I guess you call me a go-getter, a fighter. More so than an activist, I'm a fighter, because if I believe in something, I'm going to question it to the last resort. And if I can't get the answers there, I'll move on until I get the answers. I never leave any stones uncovered, mm-hmm. and I never burn my trail, so I can always go back. It's like a dog, you know, covering a bone, and then he'll go back and get that same bone and continuously work on it till it's completed. And that's where I am. I like to complete a task. When I start, I like to complete it.
What's the biggest task right now that you see as incomplete in the Belmont neighborhood?
Getting our revitalization plan to the point to where we feel comfortable that this is what is going to work in our neighborhood. We know that there are other businesses and like the Hope Six and all this stuff that got to combine into it. We understand that, but we want to see that the plans, the year that six of us went to meetings twice a week for a whole year to set this plan together. We want to at least we want people to know that we didn't waste our time. We felt like right now we wasted a lot of our time in these meetings, and for it not to go any farther than where it has gone. We see more effort put into the Hope Six, which came along later and was reinstalled into our plan, than anything that we set for a year to get started. Mm-hmm. We haven't seen any of that work start yet. We hear that they're in the process, and it's going to take time, and we know this. But if you can start Hope Six, then you should have started something of ours. Give us something to show an effort that we didn't waste our time for the time that we was there.
And of that revitalization plan, what piece of it are you most interested in seeing enacted?
Well, the main parts that we were worried about were the homeowners that was already here, the taxation. We know that it's going to be renewed. We know that the tax is going to go sky high. We already know. But we wanted to get some type of tax abatement program put in place, whereas it would give the homeowners that were here during the time that the plan was written, not your new homeowners, But the ones that had been here 5, 6, 10 years that had been fighting this length of time, give them an opportunity to put this, some funds aside to pay, to catch up with the tax increases that we had. And that hasn't happened because we had a double tax increase all of a sudden. You have a lot of people over here with fixed incomes, and it's not, they say medium to low incomes. Now we probably got medium incomes, but before, everybody's income was about the same. And with the elderly living on their own in their own homes, we know that they can't pay double taxes on their properties. Which we know that they have this little taxation program. If you're 60 and make $19,900 a year, you can get a tax break. But if you worked a good job and retired, you're going to get more than $19,900. Right. So that just, you know, you're not, that's not helping them either. So we continue to work on something, even with our attorney.
Is this Ted Follett?
No, it's, his name is Paul Steffens. He's with Kennedy and Covington. And then we're working with the state level, trying to see if they could work something out through Congress or whatever to give us like a tax program where we could, we wouldn't lose. We feel like we're going to lose one. We're not going to lose from somebody snatching our house up unless it's the tax collector or your mortgage company. That's one reason why we did decide to have attorneys working with us, because you have foreclosures now going on quite frequently. And if you can't pay your taxes, we know that, you know, eventually they can foreclose on your properties and take, seize your properties. But hopefully we can put some fire there and say, okay, you may take the property, but it won't be an easy task for you to take properties in our neighborhood. Because we feel like that's one thing, we know that's going to come, you're going to have your $100,000 homes, your $200,000 homes, you're going to have your tax increases, but you have to realize there were people here before it started. And these are the people that brought this neighborhood for you to come in and take over. It's not gun real, it's, the crime is down now due to some of the things that we as homeowners done before you even got here. So, I mean, at least give us some type of, we don't want, we're not looking for a big reward, but if you could give us a tax break, that would be a great reward so that we would be able to keep our homes. Because a lot of people are not planning to keep, they know that they're not going to be able to keep their homes.
What does home ownership represent to you?
It represents a big part of your life. It's like it's something that your parents didn't have when they were growing up or had the opportunity. My parents never owned a home. They always were renters or sharecroppers. And most of my friends, they own homes. And it's like, to me, when I became a homeowner, it was like a different step. It made me feel like a different person. You have a whole different outlook on life. You feel better. You feel like you've accomplished something. When you pay your mortgage, you feel like, oh, okay, now this will be mine sooner or later. Maybe later, but at least it's an effort. And it's something to work hard at. You have to have something in life to work towards, but else you'll get bored stiff, really. To me, I get bored easily. So I have to keep busy. I have to constantly keep busy. Because I can't sit, I read, and then I get tired of reading, and then I get, and I'm bad about working on this house. I would take out, I would paint this room one day, and then I'll come back and change the color the next day. And my kids, they, I don't know what color they expect in the house, and that's why I can't put drapes, because one day it'll be green, the next day it'll be red. I mean, it just depends. You know, if whatever paint I find and I like that color. This is one part that I like about being a homeowner. I can change my paint. I can paint any color I want to paint. I can do whatever I want to do to it. And nobody has the right to say, well, you can't do that to your walls, or you can't plant that in your yard. You know, so home ownership is a way for me. I wish more people would think that way.
It's a way for you to express who you are.
It makes you an individual. And they, I don't know, homeowners usually don't stick out in a neighborhood. Like, you can't really ride through and see, tell who's a homeowner and who's a renter, really. And that's the way I think it should be to a certain extent. But, you know, in the past, the homeowners, you could tell because it was the way the property was kept up versus your, some of your rental property. Not all the rental properties, just some of them. you could tell a difference in them. But now it's sort of hard, but you can, sometimes you can put your finger on some renters in the neighborhood, but then you, sometimes you can't, because we all are different.
Just by way of sort of wrapping up, I wanted to ask you a few kind of broad questions. We had talked about the civil rights movement a little bit yesterday, and some people would say that in 1968, when Martin Luther King was killed, the civil rights movement ended. Would you agree or disagree with that statement?
I disagree. He started it, and from his starting it, others took on, and it progressed afterwards. And it never will stop. It's going to always be progression in civil rights, because we are still fighting some of the same things that was in 68 are here now, but they're just a little bit more hidden. But for the last 2 years, I've been noticing a lot of prejudice being shown outright. It's not being hidden like it used to be. It's more obvious now, and they try to cover it or pretty it up, but it's still some out there, so it's still ongoing.
Where do you notice prejudice most still today?
Some of your jobs, some of your employers, they don't actually come out and say it, but it's, you can look at the promotional type things that they do and within the company. And then you have the movies that are just average now on TV, racial type things, this mainly. And then in the school systems, I've noticed some of the schools are letting the kids read more racial material now. Yeah, and we talked about maybe putting more black history into the school, but it's more racial type things. It's like the old books of what they read. Shamario, my grandson, in fact, is one of the ones that brought it up. You know, he brought it up to me in reference to what some of the books that y'all read now in school.
Well, most books that we read are racial. So it's A Roll of Thunder, Hear My Cry, Sea Biscuit, I say, To Kill a Mockingbird. Those most books that we don't read. Oh, in the Holocaust.
Yeah, so it's a lot of racial type things now that they're having to go back and read them. Like, well, why would you have to read those now, where you have this, all of this immigration stuff going on? And I'm thinking, is this another way to bring about an uproar or uprise or something? Because it bothers me that my child is reading. I know those are history type books, but at the same time, I think he can read other things that were done that weren't so racial. Because there are lots of nice books out there that aren't all racial. So.
So these books that are being assigned in school, do you think it's possible that they're being assigned to sort of stimulate dialogue about race?
I think it's more about the dialogue, because than actually that some of this was an accomplishment for us. And the dialogue really for them is something like slang. They can't relate to some of the words, because it's written in, what do they call it? The off-brand conversations, I call it, like, yeah, you know, and all this type of stuff. So we're teaching them a different language, like to speak a complete complete sentence. So why go back and then give them these other words to try to comprehend, which he has a lot of problem with trying to comprehend. What does that mean, those words? And, you know, and I'm like, okay, well, let me read it to you, because I can talk like that. So let me read it to you so you can comprehend it. And it's really, to me, I can't understand why they're reading them, really.
So you wish that children had more books that showed them sort of positive images of African Americans?
Is that? Yeah, because it is some positive stuff that we have done out there. And if you want to give them that history, give them positive history, not something that every time a student says something out of the way, a white versus a black, oh, that's racist. Well, I mean, you know, what else would they think if you're always reading these type books about racism? Why wouldn't they go, this is racist and you racist and blah, blah, blah? This is a whole thing that goes, he talks about, that goes on in his school. And it's not right. Who at the door? I really think racism is going to be here forever. That's a lifetime thing. It's just a matter of people being able to deal with it and move on. And a lot of people have learned to deal with it and keep moving. Mm-hmm. Because I don't feel like it didn't hinder me any. Mm-hmm. It just made me stronger. Mm-hmm. Made me work harder to succeed whatever I want to do.
And what, in your mind, is the best way to teach that to kids, to teach them how to move on?
I think by reading positive material, giving them a positive outlook on life, letting them see other sides of life. And it doesn't have to be surrounded around a bunch of racist type things. They're gonna face it anyway if they grow old. They're gonna face it one day even. And the best thing for them is to employ them and let them know this is what has happened, but this is what can happen. Let them see it's okay to read those books, but let them see, okay, this is what some have done already. This is something that can be done. This is reachable. This is a goal that you can achieve. That doesn't matter about where you came from, how you got here, but this is a goal that you can get to. Mm-hmm. And a lot of kids like that. I mean, some of the kids are confused. They don't know what they want to be when they grow up. Well, if I be this, and they ain't going to give me a promotion. And that's the wrong attitude. And I think that the parents need to work harder on their children's attitudes, impressing that it doesn't matter about now. Think about tomorrow. Mm-hmm. You know, it's all your tomorrows are not promised to you, but at least it's a dream. It's a thought. It's a good thought. Mm-hmm. We can dream. Nobody can take a dream from you, can they?
Right. What has most surprised you about how Charlotte's changed in your lifetime?
The fact that the buildings is multiplied and the roads are still the same. The highways are still the same. But the people, it has grew with population, the different groups of population. And it's great. I mean, I love it. But the lifestyle downtown is beginning to be horrendous. Ugh. I'm almost thinking I might need to move back to the country because it's so busy, constantly busy, busy, busy the whole time. And you really don't have anywhere to have privacy. Well, when I say privacy, when you know, kids have to have room to grow. And if everything is hustle and bustle, cars parked, they can't ride bikes, they can't ride motorcycles, the dogs can't play, because you got people everywhere, it's sort of hindrous, you know, for a neighborhood, really, to me. Unless everybody likes to live in a condo, and I don't think everybody likes condos. I don't. You know, it's just, to me, it's too confined.
Are there changes that you expected to see in Charlotte by now that haven't happened?
Yep. As far as I would love to see.
So you were saying that I was asking you what changes you maybe expected to see by now in Charlotte and haven't?
Well, not really. I've seen some improvement as far as the races. It has become to a level where people can move on. Mm-hmm. And I've seen that it has happened, and it still continuously happens. And people just have to work harder at being people instead of looking at people for a color. It's just people. I look at people just people. It doesn't matter the color of your skin or how you talk. Preferably, if you can speak English, I can understand you a little bit more. But if not, I've gotten to the point to where I can sort of understand Spanish a lot because I ride a lot of those on my bus.
Yeah.
And they're okay people, you know, just people being people.
Right.
If everybody would just be normal, then it would probably be better.
Mm-hmm. Is Charlotte a better place for your grandchildren than it was when you were growing up here?
Yes, they have more. It has more to offer. Much more to offer than when I was growing up here. It was more solitude. It was just, you were confined more so to what you could do and how you could do it. Mm-hmm. But now it's more open. And there's a lot of stuff out there available to kids and to people that can better society. But they just have to learn where those resources are.
Mm-hmm. Well, is there anything that I haven't asked you that you had wanted to talk about?
No, I think we've covered all of it.
All right.
Not too much.
Well, thanks so much for being generous with your time on a busy day. Yeah.
Yep. Uh-huh. They need to add more Black history
To the schools?
To the school system, and mm-hmm. it needs to be more Black history sections in our libraries. Mm-hmm. Not mm-hmm. all of the racist type, but they need to add more positive mm-hmm. history, Black history, because we do have some famous Black people that are not noticed mm-hmm. enough, and we know that they're there.
Do you remember being taught Black history when you were going through school? Did your teachers teach
when
that?
When I went through school, there was no such thing as Black history. None. You learned about Lafayette, somebody that you never knew, but you fell in love with because you had to read about them. These mm-hmm. are the only people. I never knew of a Black history, nothing about Blacks. The only thing I ever knew was what I was seeing and what I was told about, but I never read about any. Hmm. It was never in the school system, no.
You say what you were singing, did you learn something about Black history through music?
We did, and that was the only thing we could learn as far as Black history, but we didn't learn it in school. They didn't play it in school.
Oh, yeah.
We did it at home. Yeah, in church. Yeah, but no, in school, it was all white history.
Oh, yeah.
Which was Lafayette, Belbour, and what was the other people? It was a whole bunch of, yeah, Christopher Columbia, and oh, God, it was people that, these are the only people I knew about, really, unless I went out and, which I did. My parents would tell me about other Black type things, and me and my friends would talk about it. But as far as just reading it and seeing it in school, no.
Yeah.
But I think it would be good because they started this thing talking about Black History Month, mm-hmm. and I really don't see the positive part about why 1 month, why not a whole year? Mm-hmm. I mean, they had history all year, right? So why can't it be incorporated? Maybe not as much, but maybe a little at a time. To let the kids know there are some positive Black history and there were negative. They know all of the negative Black history. Hmm. So give them some positive Black history.
Mm-hmm.
All of our history is not negative. It's some positive stuff that we have accomplished.
Mm. Well, that seems like a good place to stop. Good note to end on. Thanks again.
Well, thank you for having me.